Hi, you're listening to the Professionals Playbook, a podcast that brings transparency to top performers, careers, and topics. My name is Justin Hazard Lee. I'm an F-35 fighter pilot for the Air Force. One of the most important lessons I've learned is that you have to be selective with who you listen to. There's a lot of noise out there. The goal of this podcast is to find experts who are at the top of their field to share their insights based on credibility and experience. My guest today is George Whitesides, who is the CEO and president of Virgin Galactic, the spaceflight company founded by Sir Richard Branson. With Scaled Composites, the company has developed the White Knight 2 and Spaceship 2 vehicles based on the XPRIZE winning Spaceship 1. In his role, he is responsible for guiding all aspects of the company to commercial operation at Spaceport America. Prior to Virgin Galactic, he served as chief of staff for NASA. Upon departure from the agency, he was awarded the Distinguished Service Medal, the highest award the agency confers. He is also a fellow of the UK's Royal Aeronautical Society. Today's episode is sponsored by Bremont, over-engineered watches for professionals. In the last few years, Bremont has taken over as the fighter pilot's watch. Their combination of precision, quality, and customer service is unmatched. You can see all of their watches by going to Bremont.com. Now here's a highlight from our conversation today.
We get up to about, you know, somewhere between 40 and 50,000 feet, depending on the mission. We release the spaceship. The rocket inside the spaceship activates and pushes the vehicle first forward and then up as the pilot pilots through the given trajectory. And that rocket pushes the vehicle out into space. And once we get out there, the passengers on board will be able to get out of their seats and float around the cabin. Everybody gets two windows, so everybody gets a window seat, and they'll be able to look out at the planet, look out at the stars.
In our conversation, we talk about the strengths and weaknesses of NASA, how space exploration is like aviation 100 years ago, and what the future of Virgin Galactic looks like. If you're enjoying the show and want to keep up with me, you can follow me on Instagram and Facebook at Justin Fighter Pilot. I also send out a monthly newsletter. You can sign up by going to professionalsplaybook.com. Now, without further ado, George Whitesides. George, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on. Can you talk to your background?
Great to be with you. So I've always been excited about our future in space and have pursued a career in space and also a bit in public service and in business. I mean, we can dig into it, but, you know, I've been with Virgin Galactic for almost 10 years now. And before that was, you know, at NASA, chief of staff. And before that ran a sort of a space policy organization and have worked on some other commercial space things as well. And so it's been an exciting time, you know, really amazing time in commercial space over the course of the last 20 years.
Doing a little bit of my homework, I saw that you were a certified parabolic flight coach. Can you talk to that? And do you have any stories from your time as a coach?
Yeah, so I was lucky to be involved in the sort of initial operations of a company called Zero G Corporation, which was a company, is a company, it's still around today, that wanted to bring the parabolic weightless flight to everyday people, you know. And so we set this company up. Peter Diamandis and then Byron Lichtenberg really founded it and shepherded it through the early years. And then I came on board to sort of help out with the launch period. You know, I was mostly focused on business issues, but did get a chance to fly on a bunch of parabolic flight missions and trained as a trainer for that. It was fantastic. I know in your work, you get to experience all kinds of flight dynamics, but extended microgravity, even just, you know, 20 seconds or so or whatever it is, the 727 that we were flying was miraculous and a really amazing experience. I really hope that, you know, as many people as possible get a chance to experience that over the course of their lifetime.
Did a lot of people lose their lunch their first time flying?
Not too many, actually. I think the reason that people have that impression is that, you know, NASA with their vehicle would fly many, many parabolas, you know, and they would do, you know, 40, 50, 60 parabolas. And you probably wouldn't, but like many people would probably feel a bit, you know, affected by that experience. But what we did, which I think was pretty smart, was we kept the number of parabolas to a relatively reasonable period, you know, that we could do in about an hour and a half of flying. So you do 10 to 20 parabolas, depending on the mission. And that's a number of parabolas that people seem to do okay with.
Yeah, I know, in at least in a previous life, I was flying F-16s, and we'd occasionally get the chance to give someone else a ride, and some of those didn't go so great.
Yeah,
I had to clean out the back seat. But yeah, that sounds really interesting. And then, so you moved to NASA, and what was your time at NASA like?
NASA was really exciting. It was very inspiring, honestly. I mean, obviously, we all have, you know, really high opinion of NASA and what it's accomplished and what it still accomplishes. So I came on board as a member of the transition team in 2008 for the Obama administration, and then the eventual administrator of NASA for the duration of the Obama administration, a guy named Charlie Bolden, who was a former general in the Marines as well as a NASA astronaut. He asked me to be his chief of staff for a period of time, which I did up until 2010. And so, that was just a really inspiring time when a lot was happening. It was sort of, in some ways, it was the early days of commercial space, but it was, a really exciting time where commercial crew and some of these other major programs were either just getting started or just ramping up, and people didn't quite know how they were going to turn out. But we were really excited about the potential of the American Aerospace Innovator community. And I think that has really paid off over the course of the last decade.
I've had a chance to have a couple astronauts on here, but not somebody who's been in the administration making the sausage, so to speak. So what are some of the strengths and weaknesses that NASA brings?
NASA is, of course, the major space exploration entity on the planet, and, you know, has a responsibility to, in some ways, lead the planet on human space exploration and space exploration in general. Obviously, there are a bunch of different countries now that are doing great stuff in space exploration as well. So it's not like a bipolar world like it used to be in the 60s. And that's great. That's really good. But I think, you know, what NASA can bring is huge resources over an extended period of time to a particular mission, whether that's the moon or Mars or something else. I think, the challenge obviously with NASA is that it's a huge organization, not quite as big as, you know, the Air Force or something like that, but it's a huge organization. And so learning how you can steer that and how you can make reasonable policy decisions in a context where, you know, you have 435 stakeholders in Congress, and then you have the executive branch and the White House and the industrial base and all the different subgroups and centers. There are a lot of different players in that ecosystem, and figuring out ways to maintain programs over time, figure out what are the right programs for the country, how to implement them. That's the hardest part, I think, of NASA. It's something that NASA has achieved successfully many times in the past, but I think that that's obviously the challenge that NASA has.
Yeah, I had a chance to read an article by Robert Siemens, who is the deputy administrator back in the 60s.
Yeah.
And it was pretty amazing how nimble NASA was, and they were making these rockets every few months. Do you see NASA being able to go back to that paradigm, or is there just a little bit too much bureaucracy now?
Well, the world has changed, right? You know, in those early days of NASA, there was fast iteration. There was also a lot of failures, you know, and you go back to the X programs or the Air Force programs of the 50s and 60s, fast iteration, but also a lot of failures. You look at a program like the F-35 or the F-22, the number of failures, certainly at a vehicle level, are much reduced because the amount of, you know, ground testing that we do is hugely increased, and the systems that we're building are hugely more complicated. So it's a different time. You know, I think what NASA can really take credit for is, in many ways, jumpstarting a lot of the innovation in the American aerospace sector, the commercial space sector, certainly through the COTS program, which, you know, was essentially buying rides up and back to the International Space Station. And through other programs like that, I think NASA can take a lot of credit for working productively with innovators in the private sector to develop capabilities that didn't exist, and to do it, you know, in a way, in a relative way, at a lower cost for the American taxpayer, but also to do it fast, at least for this day and age, and to develop some really great capabilities. So, you know, it's just a different era.
And then how did you become involved at Virgin Galactic?
Well, I was a customer of the company first. So in 2005, I bought two tickets for my wife and I So before I was involved in the company at all, I just really wanted to go to space. It seemed like the most likely pathway for me to do that was through Galactic. And I figured that if anybody was going to solve this really hard problem, which involved building a ship that was safe, having the money to really see it through, and the business acumen to like develop a really great business with marketing and all the other aspects of that, I said, you know, Richard Branson is probably the guy who's going to be able to do that. And so that's why I put down $400,000 in 2005 to buy those tickets for my wife, Loretta, and I. And then it was just sort of, I guess, by chance that 5 years later, they called me up and said, hey, you know, we're looking to hire our first CEO. Do you want to do it? So I came on board, you know, at a time when the company was maybe, I don't know, a few dozen people. Now we're nearly 1,000 and, you know, flown to space a few times, gone public. A lot's happened, but it's been quite an adventure.
Yeah. What was that first interaction, first time meeting Richard Branson like?
Well, you know, it made a real impression on me because we had lunch in a restaurant in New York somewhere. And so we happened to arrive at the restaurant at the same time. And he held the door for me and my wife. And I was like, wow, this is a billionaire. And he's, you know, got the common courtesy to hold the door open. And, you know, he's just a very gracious and civil human being on first impression. And in fact, he actually is, you know. And I mean, one of the reasons that I feel so lucky is to have the chance to work with Richard on an ongoing basis, because he really is an incredible human being. I mean, he's founded something like, I actually don't know the number, but it's a dozen or more billion-dollar companies, which is crazy. I mean, I don't know of any organization any individual that's founded, you know, billion-dollar companies in like 12 different areas. You know, I mean, certainly there are companies that have built up businesses with, you know, billion-dollar businesses within them, but, you know, to set up different businesses of 12 different kinds and create unicorns or billion-dollar businesses in all of them is just absolutely incredible. So he's an amazing entrepreneur, but he's also just a really good human being who cares about the world and cares about, you know, policies that are good for the planet and good for people. So it's really great to be able to work with him.
What's a typical problem-solving session like when you guys are trying to solve a really difficult problem? What kind of strengths do you guys both bring to the table?
Well, Richard is like literally the world's best entrepreneur, and he is always thinking about the positive aspects of any given situation. Even if something doesn't go the way we expect or something, he's always got an attitude where he thinks about, okay, well, this is a way that we can make the best of that situation. So he's a really amazing tactical thinker. He's a really amazing commercial thinker. He's a really amazing constructor of basic businesses and how you present those businesses to the public. I think, I don't know, what I bring is probably, you know, some organization, you know, that's helpful and a bit deeper background in some of the technical aspects of space technology, right? I mean, so Richard doesn't have a deep background in that, although over the course of the last decade and a half, he's probably gotten it. He probably feels like he has a PhD in space technology now after the last decade. But I think that, you know, that's a nice match. And obviously, I mean, we're augmented by many, many people, both within Virgin Group and within Virgin Galactic and TSC. So it's no longer just a couple people sitting around the table.
What does a typical day look like for you?
I travel a lot. We went public in the fall of 2019, and so I have to now interact with more investor stakeholders than I used to. So, you know, a year ago, I just had two investors, and that was Virgin Group, or Richard Branson, and a firm from Abu Dhabi called Mubadala. Now we have, you know, many, many different investors through the public markets, and many of them have a lot of great things to share with us in terms of how we could lead the business forward and different opportunities we could take. So I have the opportunity to speak with those folks periodically. And so that's helpful. So I travel a lot, but also I'm often in the factory. Like I'm in the factory right now and I'm looking out at two different spaceships, one of which has flown to space, one of which we hope to fly once we get through the test flight program for that second vehicle. And that's awesome. You know, I mean, that's really why we're here, is to fly. That's the core thing about our company is we want to fly. We want to fly safely and we want to fly frequently. We want to open space flight up to the general public. So that is really why we're all here. And every day is different because it involves a mix of factory stuff, organizational stuff, business stuff, investor stuff, and, you know, interactions with Richard and other stakeholders.
And having had a chance to lead the team for the last decade, what's been the toughest leadership challenge while you've been there?
I think the number one thing with a company like Galactic is that what I like to say is we're in this marathon sprint, you know, and by that, I mean, you know, we're always moving forward aggressively from one milestone to another milestone to another milestone. But yet, because it's aerospace technology, these programs take a long time to get set up. It's not unusual for a new human carrying vehicle or human piloted vehicle to take, you know, 10 years of flight test or whatever. And so just maintaining the spirit within the team so that we're looking towards the next milestone, we're excited about the next milestone, we're working through the challenges that we encounter within that phase, and then we're on to the next one. And maintaining the spirit through that 10-year period, through the ups and downs, you know, we've had a bunch of great ups recently, but, you know, certainly we've had our share of challenges between, you know, flight test accidents and other things. So, you know, just maintaining that long-term spirit and vision and keeping the essential flame of what we're trying to do alight inside of everybody's hearts, that's probably the main thing that I think about the most.
What's your leadership style like? How do you interact with the team to try and get the most out of them?
I'm not a big flamethrower. Other people are, and by that, or whatever, I don't know what the right phrase is. So I am a relatively even-keeled guy. And my basic personality is to try to understand a problem, try to be reality-based in how we address that problem, and then to solve that problem and to keep moving forward. And, you know, I think you can have successful management styles for different people. There are people who are much more fiery than I am. There are probably people who are maybe a step or two more placid and calm, maybe. But I'm more on the let's hear the problem and let's deal with it. The interesting thing about space technology is, you know, they're big organizations and there's a lot of stuff going on inside them. And I think that it's important to maintain an attitude in which one is open to hearing both good and bad news. Because if you present down to the organization that you don't want bad news, then people stop telling you the bad news. But it doesn't mean that the bad news stops happening. It just means that you stop hearing about it. And so I think with any organization, but particularly organizations which are privileged to carry human beings on board their vehicles or whatever, it's really important to maintain an attitude in which bad news or challenges, you know, are addressed openly, are brought to the table and handled, because that's the way you move towards safer vehicles. That's the way you move towards successful businesses. And so that's sort of a general philosophy that I have.
And can you talk to what the overall mission of Virgin Galactic is?
Sure. Our mission is to open space for all. It's to contribute to the creation of a new era in which human spaceflight is available to many more people than has been the case in the past. We believe that by sharing the perspective of space, that more and more people will be able to understand that, you know, at heart, Earth is basically one big spaceship. It's one that really requires us to take care of it and to help manage it in some ways. And so I really believe that the perspective shift of space, which some people call the overview effect, is one that's really important to share with the planet. And particularly in this day and age when we have these terrible Australian wildfires and Californian wildfires and CO2 levels going up and everything, we really need to have a very holistic planetary view of our home and to basically come up with solutions that are global in nature. And I think that the space perspective is an important aspect of that approach.
I've had a chance to see some of the videos of your rocket going into space, and it's incredible. And you have the spaceport in New Mexico. But can you describe how you guys are getting to space, the point of the spaceport is, and how you're expanding?
Sure. Yeah. So basically, from a systems perspective, we have an air launch system. And what that means is we have a spaceship, which is a winged rocket plane, in essence, that is carried aloft by a carrier aircraft, which is essentially a a jet, four engine jet. And like many of the early X-planes, we take our key vehicle up under, you know, just general jet power. We get up to about, you know, somewhere between 40 and 50,000 feet, depending on the mission. We release the spaceship. The rocket inside the spaceship activates and pushes the vehicle first forward and then up as the pilot pilots through the given trajectory. And that rocket pushes the vehicle out into space. And once we get out there, the passengers on board will be able to get out of their seats and float around the cabin. Everybody gets two windows, so everybody gets a window seat, and they'll be able to look out at the planet, look out at the stars. And then at the end of the microgravity period or weightlessness period, they'll get back in their seats and will re-enter. We have a patented re-entry system for that, in which essentially the wings sort of bend up at an angle to encourage a stable re-entry. And then it comes back and it glides to a horizontal runway landing. In other words, it lands like, you know, any other aircraft does on a runway. And we think that that's a nice way to come back to the planet Earth. It's sort of the same way that the space shuttle came back down. And we do it out of this amazing facility in New Mexico called Spaceport America, which is just this incredible, incredible place on planet Earth. I encourage, you know, once we get up and running, I hope as many people as possible could go down there and watch a flight and see the spaceport. It's really like plucked out of the future. It's this beautiful, beautiful facility that was designed by a guy named Norman Foster, who's one of the most famous architects on the planet. You know, he and his team just did an incredible job of creating this purpose-built facility for us and for other commercial space ventures. And that's where we're going to do it. And we'll train our folks down there, train our future astronauts down there, and then they'll fly to space from southern New Mexico.
And how high are you guys getting up? I think it's, what, over 300,000 feet?
Yeah, so in the U.S., you get your astronaut wings if you're in the U.S. Armed Forces or in NASA. If you go above 50 miles, which, as you say, is a little bit under 300,000 feet, our trajectories will be around 300,000 feet at the very start. And then so basically, you got to go above 50 miles.
And have you gotten a chance to ride up there?
I have not. I do expect that I will, though, which will be exciting. One of our great employees here, a woman named Beth Moses, who is our chief astronaut instructor, she flew to space earlier in 2019. And she was somebody who had helped train many, many astronauts inside of the Johnson Space Center over the years. But this was the first time that she had actually gone to space. And she reports back that it is actually just a really amazing experience. So that's great. And I look forward to having that experience.
I know Richard Branson is famous for saying he's going to take the first commercial ride. Are you going to be right next to him for that?
We'll see. You know, Richard's flight is the really important one, and that's the one that we're working really hard on this year. I think when I fly is not yet determined, so we'll figure that out. That's less important than Richard's flight.
You guys were saying this is the big year, right, coming up?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, this is the year. So we intend to fly Richard this year and to start commercial service. You know, this is a huge milestone. It's one that we've been working towards for many, 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 many years. It's going to be amazing. You know, maybe just at some point you'll be able to come out and watch a flight with us. But, you know, when the ship comes off the carrier aircraft and lights its rocket and you start seeing that contrail going essentially straight up, almost exactly straight up, it is very non-boring when that happens. And there's an incredible just mood in the crowd down on the ground. And there's a lot of electricity on board the vehicle too, just people getting very, you know, mental electricity, people getting excited about the prospect of going to space. So, you know, it's just an amazing, amazing thing. And I just can't imagine, it's generally amazing. And then to have Richard Branson on board will be, I don't know, quadruply amazing or whatever. So it's going to be a big milestone. That's what we're working towards this year.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. What's the training like for a regular passenger that's going up?
Well, we're going to have 3 days of training before you fly. So if you were to fly with us, you would come down to New Mexico and we would give you training on the vehicle, on what you're going to be doing when you get into space, when you get out of your seat, what do you do, how do you move around the cabin, How do you get back in your seat when we ask you to? We'll train you on, you know, safety stuff just to make sure that everybody's safe inside the vehicle. And, you know, we'll also do a little bit of that stuff that I was just talking about in terms of the space perspective. You know, what are people going to be doing when they come back down? You know, I think it's going to be a life-changing experience for many people. And many people hope to use the platform that they'll have from becoming an astronaut in a good way. And, you know, and they'll use that platform in many different ways. You know, people are interested in different causes. But what does unite, I think, many of the folks who want to fly is they are excited about sharing their passion about space with other people, particularly young people. And they're excited in many cases about sharing, you know, how they saw planet Earth, how they saw their home planet, spaceship Earth. And so I think that that will be, in its own way, a really important legacy for the company as it creates this community, this bigger community of people who have flown, not just engineers or amazing pilots like yourself, but also folks who are artists or poets or photographers or house husbands, housewives, all different kinds of folks who will be flying to space for the first time. And I think that that's important because it's going to change the character of how we perceive space. It will move from this professional domain, which is primarily inhabited by professional astronauts, to a domain which is, you know, shared and occupied by humanity at large. And that is a really fundamental part of humanity's expansion into the cosmos off of planet Earth. I think that that shift is one that, you know, presages this grand future for humanity, you know, the coming thousands of years, hundreds of years, thousands of years, where we, you know, take care of planet Earth, but also explore beyond and, you know, learn more about our universe. That's a really exciting future. And we just happen to have been born in the period where we begin that expansion off the planet.
And so once you get up there, you unstrap, and then how much weightlessness do you get? And then are there people there helping you get back into your seat?
Yeah. So no, there is not currently planned to have anybody helping you back into your seat. That's what we'll be focused on as part of our training. We've already practiced it on board a zero-G flight, a parabolic weightless flight with sort of a real cabin. So we have a pretty good sense that it's going to be fine, but we do need to, you know, do that a few more times using essentially test passengers, you know, internal employees to make sure that that all works fine. We will have two pilots on board the vehicle. And so if somebody did have trouble getting into their seats, then one of the pilots could help out with that. The vehicle can really be flown by just one pilot if need be. But we have two pilots for safety and redundancy and to reduce the per pilot workload. Yeah. So from takeoff to landing, the flight is about 60 to 90 minutes, depending on the particular trajectory of the day. I like to say in general, it's about 90 minutes because that's what it has been most frequently or around then. And then you're in space for about 5 minutes of that. Obviously, you know, the whole experience is taking these, you know, sort of 90 minutes. But the part where you're actually sort of directly in space and in zero G is about a little less than 5 minutes.
And then what's the training like for the pilots? Are they the same pilots that fly the mothership and then they take turns flying the rocket ship?
Yeah. So we cross train between the carrier aircraft and the spaceship. And the intent is that, you know, once we've had the chance to fly a bunch of sorties, then people will be cross trained across both vehicles. Right now, the training is sort of what you would imagine. We have a simulator, which is quite accurate now. It's fixed base, but it's quite accurate simulator. So it gives the pilots a good chance to test nominal and off nominal trajectories, do a bunch of sim runs, as I'm sure you do. And then we also have an extra, so like a, you know, an aerobatic plane, so they can put themselves through, I don't know, whatever you guys do, 8 to 10 G's or something crazy. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, on the average mission, we would never see G's anywhere close to that. You know, our G's are going to be more like 3 to 4 G's. But they can keep up their G tolerance. We also bring in jet trainers periodically so people can have that experience. Every single one of our pilots was a former military test pilot, a very accomplished former military test pilot in their own right, all with, obviously, with jets. And so these are folks who have a great background in high-performance aircraft.
What does that boost profile look like? And is it automated or are they hand-flying that whole profile?
They're hand flying it. We have some aids, some computer aids for that flight, for that trajectory, but they're basically hand flying it. And the boost is about 60 seconds of rocket powered propulsion, order of magnitude. You're going from, you know, whatever the release airspeed is of the carrier aircraft up, you know, past Mach 1. Quite quickly, Mach 2, Mach 3, you peak out a bit above Mach 3, going almost straight vertical, not quite all the way, not completely straight, but almost all the way straight vertical. And then after 60 seconds, the rocket motor burns out and, you know, instantly everybody inside the cabin is weightless, which is quite an amazing experience, I'm told. And the vehicle will then sort of pitch over to allow the customers to really get a great view of the Earth, and then it'll, and then the pilot will stabilize using the reaction control thrusters that we have on board the vehicle. And then once the vehicle is getting closer to reentry, the vehicle will pitch again and come down, essentially sort of bottom side down. And then, you know, the rest of the reentry sequence happens, and then landing.
I thought it was really interesting how the wings fold or turns into like a shuttlecock in space. I don't think any other manned aircraft has done that. The X-15 came back pretty much like a plane. The space shuttle came back just like a plane. So what was the engineering, I guess, impetus for that?
Well, the interesting thing is, so one other vehicle did, which was Spaceship One, of course, which is what Spaceship Two is based off of. And the basic innovation that the scaled composite engineers came up with was the following challenge. During the X-15 program, you had to fly the reentry profile quite precisely, or else you could have certain control issues on the way in. The feather turns the vehicle almost into like a shuttlecock, or in some ways almost like a capsule, where it is relatively insensitive to precise pointing, and it'll just sort of come down, and aerodynamic forces will right the vehicle and keep it properly oriented throughout the reentry. One of the most beautiful things that I've ever seen was the reentry of our last flight to space. And it just is super rock solid as it just comes down. And what's nice about that is, A, it's very stable. It's an aerodynamically stable configuration. So the pilots could literally take their hands off of the stick and it would come down in the right direction. But it also is essentially a high drag configuration for higher up in the atmosphere. And so you slow down higher quickly. And what that means is that you don't have quite the same level of heating or loads that you would have on the vehicle if you did by sort of pulling out of it, you know, screaming out at, you know, 45,000 feet or something. Now, in theory, actually, the vehicle could do that. But it's sort of not encouraged. It would be very high Gs on the pullout, and it would be probably fairly high thermal loads on the way down. And so what the feather allows us to do is to sort of break high up in the atmosphere, just at, you know, really at the edge of the atmosphere, break and then defeather and then become a glider. And as you say, there are different ways of doing it. You can do it under a capsule with parachutes or whatever, but this is a way to do it. And what it does mean is that you come down as just a runway landing, which is a nice way to come down.
Does that help with reusability, that it doesn't get really hot and you don't need to repack parachutes and things like that?
In theory, it should. You know, I think we all will have a lot to learn about operations and turnaround times and inspections and, you know, just no one's really done a, well, that's not true. So the X-15 program did have a fairly high turnaround time. You know, that was about as close as we've ever gotten to a high cycle, rapid turnaround space vehicle. And so we aspire to do that and go beyond that, you know, to have airframes that are turned around even more frequently in some cases, and certainly for a longer period of time. And so, you know, we certainly have a lot to do, but we do think that having this sort of horizontal takeoff, horizontal landing should in theory exert less loads on the vehicle and would be a good way to sort of have high reusability ongoingly.
How many times has the Spaceship Two, how many times has it been into space?
So it's been to space. Well, this vehicle that we're using now, Unity, has been to space twice. It's had a bunch more rocket powered flights as we've sort of incremented up the flight test profiles, and it's done even more number of glide flights, but it's been to space two times.
And it sounds like there's some uncertainty in how long it will last. Are there predictions like a couple dozen, a couple hundred times?
We actually think that we're going to be able to get, you know, on the order of like 10 years of service from this vehicle. Obviously, we need to prove that. We'll certainly have, you know, engineering work to do to prove that to ourselves. We'll have to do a lot of inspections as we go along to make sure that we're operating a safe airframe. You know, in theory, the nice thing about composite materials is that if you design it correctly, you know, it can almost be fatigue-free. And so we should be able to have quite high cycle life. Combined with sort of the basic architecture of the trajectory and the thermal protection systems that we have on board, we really hope to have, you know, many hundreds of cycles, if not, you know, low thousands of cycles on these airframes.
Do you guys need any sort of heat shield?
We do need some thermal protection on the vehicle. It's different than what the space shuttle used. The space shuttle, being an orbital vehicle, had a lot of kinetic energy, you know, and it was also a very big vehicle. And so it had to use a, you know, quite substantial thermal protection system on its bottom, you know, these famous tiles, you know, that are sort of individually crafted that had tremendous properties, but were fairly fragile, a bit brittle. All we really need is a bit of thermal protection on some key areas, sort of the front, the nose, the leading edges, and some of the areas back by the rocket motor. So we have three different systems. We have a almost like a thermally conditioned felt material. If you felt it, it would be like felt. It's not felt, but it's sort of like that. They actually use that on the space shuttle. We bought a bunch of it from suppliers related to the space shuttle program. They used it on the cool parts of the space shuttle. We use it on our hottest parts on our vehicle. And then we also have a sort of a paste-like substance that is used for areas that are tricky to maybe wrap the felt around, and so something that's easier to put on. And then we also use a reflective material for radiative heating called Kapton in the back of the vehicle. So we have a few different systems around the vehicle, each tailored to whatever the thermal environment is for that part of the vehicle.
And are you having to refurbish and add some of this stuff every certain number of flights?
Once we've dialed it in, we don't expect to have to refurb the TPS ongoingly. None of it's ablative. In theory, if we dial it in correctly, and this is what we think we've done, is it should just be, you know, we'll have to inspect it, obviously, to make sure that nothing's flaked off or whatever. But because it's not, you know, burning off like the bottom of a orbital space capsule, it should be good to go to turn around and fly again.
And so what are the next 5 to 10 years look like for Virgin Galactic?
Well, you know, I think I try to, you know, be both ambitious in our vision, but also practical. You know, we have a lot of work in front of us to scale up the operations curve to go from a few flights a year to many, many flights a year. And that's going to take some effort. It's going to take great people working together to understand the systems and to make sure that we're flying safely, because at the end of the day, that's the most important thing. I do hope over the course of the next 5 years that we've flown a few thousand people to space. I think that would be a huge success. You know, you talk to the airlines and the airlines fly a few thousand people, you know, in a few hours. You know, given how few people have been able to access space, only about, you know, 550 or, you know, less than 600 people have been to space since the dawn of the space age, since Yuri Gagarin flew in 1961. So few people have flown that having, you know, just another 500 people would be a huge success. You know, just to double the number of people who've flown to space would be a huge success. To triple it, quadruple it, you know, those simple multiples will bring huge numbers of more people to space. So that, you know, I think I like to say that, you know, in 10 or 20 years, the kids that we're having today, you know, will grow up in a world where almost everybody knows somebody who has been to space. Whereas right now, you know, other than space nerds, you know, I think we live in a world where most people do not know somebody who's been to space, don't know a NASA astronaut or a European astronaut. And so, you know, I think that accessibility is super important, because, you know, it'll be a time when people know people who've been to space, and it's part of the culture, and space will be more part of the culture. And I think the perspective of space, like we were talking about earlier, will be more a part of the culture.
Seems almost like aviation was almost exactly 100 years ago in the 1920s. People probably barely knew of a person that ever flew an airplane.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, it really does feel like that at this moment. You look at the early years of you know, the Wright brothers just having a few flights. It's a fascinating parallel, right? The spaceship in 2004, you know, just about 100 years separating the first Wright brothers flights. You know, it wasn't really until the 20s where big time, you know, commercial aviation really took off. There was a lot of stuff happening in the teens, the 19-teens. And clearly, you know, aviation is going to have much higher numbers of people flying. But that sort of early sense of excitement where you have a few different designs, you know, you have us and then a few other companies that are bringing commercial space vehicles to the market. You have a bunch of spaceports being developed, like the early days where you had, you know, early airfields being developed and early airports being constructed. And just the whole industry, you know, being created is sort of what we're doing now. And I think that that's really exciting. I like to say to the people who work in the company to remember these days, because they're going to be days that you're going to be able to tell your kids and your grandkids that you were there for them. And I really do believe that's true.
What does your production schedule look like? How often are you guys building these new ships, and how many ships do you plan on building?
We are building two more spaceships right now. I can look out that way and see one of them. And then there's another one right behind that. One we hope to finish manufacturing of this year and move through test flight and hopefully get some commercial flights off. And then the next one is scheduled for next year. And then the hope is to really have one every year and to go along in that respect.
And so talking to the next five to 10 years, are you planning on continuing the suborbital flights where you land at the same base you took off of? Or what is the, I guess, next generation profile look like? Does it mean flying across the Atlantic, or does it mean trying to get into orbit?
Yeah, that's really the hope, is that what we would love to do is to take the technologies that we've developed and new ones as well, and to develop high-speed transportation technologies for our system. I think that is eminently doable. We'll be flying the only hypersonic human-rated airframe, I think, for the foreseeable future. And that's a really exciting area. It's in some ways it's crazy that we've been going Mach 0.8, you know, since the retirement of the Concorde, and really since the dawn of the space age, or sorry, the jet age. We have new technologies that can enable us to do supersonic and hypersonic flight, and I think we look forward to contributing to that new industry.
What would one of those profiles look like?
Well, of course, you can do it in different ways. You can do it in a rocket power trajectory, which would entail, you know, higher Gs right at the start, although they could be moderated, and then heading over, on a cross track, and then coming into landing at another spaceport. I'm actually excited about hypersonic technologies. Of course, the propulsion stuff needs still to get some details worked out, but I think, the general idea of having an airport-to-airport solution that is, you know, at least supersonic, if not hypersonic, is something that is super exciting to people. And obviously, there's a lot of work to do, but that could be something that's very exciting.
Do you think that's more than like a decade away?
Well, I think we could have prototypes within 5 years. I think that, full commercial service is more like a decade away probably, but I think that, you know, you could have prototypes that are flying people, probably pilots like yourself and others, you know, within 5 years or so.
How do you see some of the other commercial, I don't even know if you guys think of them as competitors, maybe you do or don't, but like Blue Origin, SpaceX, are you guys going after the same market, or are you guys going in different directions?
I think we're going after different markets. You know, SpaceX is sort of focused on launching big satellites, or at least large collections of satellites into space, and is sort of interested in space exploration, same with Blue Origin. Blue Origin will have a competitive vehicle to what we're doing. And they've got a great team, great engineers, great people. It's a different kind of architecture. I think the market will be big enough for both of us. In general, the space launch, or at least human space flight, everybody's sort of pursuing a somewhat different strategy. So I think that we'll have a few different areas to where there won't be huge competition within the different sectors.
And where can people keep up and follow along with what you guys are doing? And have you guys announced a first flight date?
We generally don't announce our flight dates just because we want to let the engineers who are running the flight test program do their thing. But, you know, the next milestones will be bringing the spaceship Unity down to New Mexico for some test flights. And then eventually we'll fly Richard Branson, and then eventually we'll start flying commercial passengers. And we're going to take each step by step, but it's going to be a really exciting year.
That's really exciting. Well, George, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Justin. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to review it. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Justin Fighter Pilot. I've also started a monthly newsletter where I send out a few useful or insightful things that have helped me over the last month. You can sign up by going to professionalsplaybook.com and clicking on the red subscribe button. The link to the newsletter is also in the show notes. Today's episode was brought to you by Bremont, over-engineered watches for professionals. In the last few years, Bremont has taken over as the fighter pilot's watch. Their combination of precision, quality, and customer service is unmatched. You can see all of their watches by going to Bremont.com. Today's episode was edited by Trevor Cabler. Again, thanks for listening. I'll talk to you in 2 weeks.